A Whip for a Good Horse, Part 2. You know, when we put this new sutra book together, we were talking about how there's something in it to agitate everyone. Tori Enji was the author of this piece. He was a disciple, an heir, Dharma heir of the great Rinzai teacher Hakuin, Japanese teacher. And he wrote a letter to a samurai to encourage his practice. This letter is now known as A Whip for a Good Horse. Part two of this abridged letter, as we have it demarcated in Living Vow Zen Sutra Book, discusses three important Buddhist teachings: the 12 links of dependent origination, the 6 realms, and the 6 paramitas. I've given separate talks about each of these teachings, and you can find them on our website, Morningstar's website, so I invite you to check those out. I go into depth about each one of them separately. So tonight, I want to consider what Enji implies about how these three teachings relate with each other. So before I dive in, a quick note on the title. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha states, "Be like a good horse. Touched gently by the whip, the horse moves forward with power and energy. Have an abundance of confidence, good conduct, effort, concentration. Be aware and attentive. Put aside this great mass of suffering." So the title of this piece is inspired by the Buddha's teaching from this ancient Pali text, which invites us to be responsive in our practice in order to alleviate suffering. Tori Enji begins this section of his letter by saying that the 12 links of dependent origination produce, quote, obstructions. We must imagine he means obstructions to enlightenment, obstructions to enlightenment and awakening. Obstructions to the alleviation of suffering. So briefly, the 12 links are ignorance, which is the kind of fundamental belief that things exist as separate entities and with fixed essences. We project our concepts of things into them and see them as solid nouns rather than as just processes. Volition is the desire to protect our personal existence. Name and form distinguish my body from everything else and divide reality into this and that. Consciousness tries to pin things down into fixed categories. You'll notice these are all kind of related. Sense faculties are often interpreted as inside the human mind, like we sense things. And contact is the way we view objects as external to us. So the sense faculties contact objects that are external. There's a kind of fundamental duality in that model of how we think about perception. Feelings can be a burden to us, especially when misconceived as, you know, nouns, and when categorized as good and bad. Craving, we're up to 8 now. Craving is the way we seek good feelings without recognizing that the seeking itself is painful. Clinging results when we try to hold on to things that produce good feelings. Becoming. This, I think, is right at the heart of the 12 links. I've kind of overlooked it in the past, but I started really thinking about this time. Becoming describes the way our craving and clinging and their corollary, aversion, like if you like something, you don't like something else, it's opposite, what you view as its opposite. The way these become habit minds that drive our lives. These are the three poisons in Buddhism. The basic engine that drive us to be reborn, this is what's meant by becoming, and you heard him allude to this in A Whip for a Good Horse, reborn endlessly in the six realms, which are described, and I'll get to that in a bit, sort of metaphorically speaking. So there's like that direct link between these 12 links of dependent origination and the six realms. And then birth is the notion of a separate self and an external world. We might think of it that way. And old age and death arise when we believe we exist as separate entities that can die. So, the 12 links are experienced as obstructions to awakening when we believe that relative truths, these provisional designations we make about things, I am this, you are that, when we relate with those as if they were absolute truths, particularly the belief that our ever-changing self has an innate, unchanging quality. So the fundamental ignorance described in the 12 links is the belief that things exist as separate, fixed entities. Buddha said that the root of suffering is our belief in Atman, abiding selfhood. This is why he taught Anatman, no separate fixed self. Based on this kind of root ignorance of the way we actually exist, we often will elevate ourself over all other beings and strive to protect our self and our personal experience, whom we view as like a constant companion. And this is what motivates us often to break precepts. So I think it's actually very subtle the way we do this. Usually we're unconscious of this kind of operating system, I like to call it that. We need a glimpse of non-duality to realize that there is another way, and we call this glimpse awakening. It's true in a relative sense that I am not you, you are not me, I should not get in your car in the end of the evening. Recognizing relative truths allows us to distinguish between a hawk and a handsaw. However, because we tend to be Aristotelian in our logic, we adhere to this principle of non-contradiction. We often neglect the awareness that we are also utterly interwoven. We inter-are. So both sides of this coin are true. We are separate waves, to use Thich Nhat Hanh's metaphor, and we are one body of water. The 12 links of dependent origination illustrate for us how what Trungpa calls the bureaucracy of ego tends to take control. When we only perceive the relative truth of separate existences, we feel lonely and isolated from the universe and from each other. We tend to create enemies. We make ourselves the center of the universe with everything else existing, you know, outside of us. So there's me and there's everything outside of me. This lack of alignment with the way things actually exist on a deeper level propels us through the six realms. So the six realms. Torianji describes the incarnations of the six realms as human, who are benign, demigods who are jealous and angry with one another, hungry ghosts who cling to things that are impermanent, animals who are fearful and filled with desire, hell fiends whose rage never dies down, and heavenly beings whose minds are still and peaceful. As Tori Engie writes, even in one day there is floating and sinking. Truly, we should see how much we wander in the course of a day. What I love about this statement is Tori Engie's humble acknowledgement that wandering through the six realms is just part of life. Why? Because the relative truth that we exist as separate beings is true to our conventional understanding. And we need this way of understanding to function in the world, set boundaries. We need to be able to tell a hawk from a handsaw or edible food from poison. However, we get lost in our delusions sometimes. We call this like delusive certainty. Then act in ways that are harmful. So we need the precepts, moral guideposts, to help wake us up when we're possessed by delusions. For even with decades of practice, we will inevitably get sucked into confusion from time to time. It's humbling, but it's true. So our path is to wake up, atone, vow, and keep practicing. However, when we only experience life according to the relative truths of our provisional categorizations, remember that's like this and that, you know, that's a bell, that this is the floor, that's a stick, I'm me, you're you. So these are provisional categorizations, they aren't permanent. We can get lost in the six realms and cannot wake up. So when we only experience reality according to these provisional categorizations, we get lost. We unconsciously take our categorizations, our mental formations that describe reality, as the absolute truth. And this leads us to seek permanent refuge in provisional truths that are actually ephemeral, temporary. Our tendency to get lost in conceptual maps is the root of samsara, the hamster wheel on which we run to secure happiness for ourselves. We aim to secure happiness in relation to something that we imagine will be permanent. Maybe it's a house, a loved one, great wealth, or a blissful mental state. These are actually forms of self-seeking. They're based on the delusion that a permanent happy state can be attained by some separate fixed entity called ourself. We are lost in what Barry Magid calls the pursuit of happiness. And the pursuit itself is dukkha, a kind of suffering. A lack of openness to and appreciation of the way things are in this very moment. We are too busy trying to become something else to realize the beauty of what is. This form of self-seeking may fold into our spiritual practice. We might imagine that the goal of practice is to be a heavenly being or attain some sort of fixed state called enlightenment. And this spiritual goal drives further seeking, preventing us from appreciating what we are here and now. Trungpa calls this spiritual materialism. We may occasionally succeed at attaining some sort of blissful state and then think, now I've made it. Feeling, maybe even feeling special. And the sense of self forms around this transient state. I have made it. And when, of course, it inevitably passes, we feel like failures. Failure may lead us to be more jealous or angry or hungry for more bliss. Our self-interest propelling us again through those six realms including the hell realms where we combat each other for our personal desires. We may criticize ourselves, believing for myriad reasons that we are not good enough. We set up our scales and measure our spiritual practice constantly. How am I doing? Again, at the center is a belief that there is some separate entity called a self that can be measured and fixed. Seeking a different life becomes our addictive habit, driven by ignorance, greed, and aversion. So what's Zen's medicine? Torianji suggests what he calls the six transcendences, more commonly termed the six paramitas or the six perfections. These are quite similar to the Eightfold Path. However, if we're not careful, we can find ourselves practicing the six paramitas or the Eightfold Path in our habitual kind of self-seeking, self-centered way, aiming to be something other than what we are, leading us right back into the cycle of samsara. We sort of imagine getting to the end of the path somewhere in the future. We can berate ourselves when we make mistakes, glorify ourselves when we fulfill vows. All of this is extra. Hakuin, Enji's teacher, wrote, "The six paramitas have their source in Zazen." I've quoted this lately. Why do they have their source in Zazen? What is it? How is it that the perfections have their source in this very simple practice of our sitting together and just paying attention? The idea is that when we sit and look deeply into the relative truth of our separate self, we don't find a separate self at all. We find interbeing, or the words here can start to fail. The notion of a separate self, which is the root of our suffering, is seen as merely a provisional designation with no innate fixed referent. There is no constant companion. It's a mirage. We also see that all mental states are ephemeral. So we can stop trying to attain some permanent state for this self that does not exist in the way we thought it did. Wisdom, one of the six paramitas, is recognizing that there is no abiding separate self and that no phenomena exist independently or with fixed essences. Craving thus loses its power, for we know we can't hold on to anything. I know this sounds disappointing, but it's a huge relief to let things be just as they are. It's a relief to stop concerning ourselves so much with senses of self and just see that they come and go. It's actually possible to open beyond these relative truths, these conceptions that divide this from that, and to awaken to boundless intimacy. By staying curious about what is, not believing all the stories we tell ourselves, we're made of non-self elements, air, words, passing feelings, the sounds of the world, one another. In this moment, you are part of my life. I am part of your life. You are my life in this moment, literally. My life is not a separate thing. That is not to say I do not exist, but I never exist in the way I think I do. As the Heart Sutra states, there is no eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind. Because no aspect of the self functions without its non-self elements. If there is no object to be seen, there is no vision. There is no I that functions separately. Everything arises interdependently. There is no birth, no old age, no death. Because in an absolute sense, there is no separate, unchanging self that could die. The realization of intimacy with all beings is the medicine that heals our divided minds and the world. We see through the division between self and other that drives our suffering and causes us to behave selfishly. Our inherent interbeing, discovered in meditation. I just don't think we can see this by thinking our way through it all. I think it is this practice of looking deeply into what we actually are. This is the wisdom at the root of the remaining paramitas of morality, effort, patience, and generosity. Practicing acts of generosity while harboring separate conceptions of giver, receiver, and gift reifies separateness and often feels condescending. As we read in our meal chant, we should see that, quote, emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift. Then we are truly honoring the paramita of generosity, for we have given up believing in separate selves. Wisdom, the true source of all the paramitas, is the deep realization that we do not exist as separate fixed entities. We realize wisdom in the practice of meditation, the effort of looking deeply into what we actually are, in realizing our lack of a separate self. We care for others as ourselves, as our own lives. This is an uncontrived embodiment of the six paramitas. So here's the key. We don't discover the inherent intimacy of all beings by aiming toward being something other than what we are. Aiming to be something other than what we are is just more of what I saw in this hilarious film at one point. He called it the self-selfing the self. In Zazen, we are invited to let go of our expectation to be different. The practice is to realize what we actually are, not what we think we are or what we think we should be. Thich Nhat Hanh describes this as the practice of aimlessness. Recognizing interbeing in this very moment, no need to seek elsewhere. This is a peace that surpasseth all understanding. Can we aim to be aimless? So this is where entrusting ourselves to the Sangha and to our practice comes in. We just keep throwing ourselves into the fire of practice where our forms illuminate our nature, which is no nature at all. Just keep sitting still, being quiet, paying attention, not trying to be something different, just looking into what we are. Be curious about what is. Answer that question not with your mind, but with your body. Walk in the Zendo with the Sangha, with no hope of getting anywhere. And the walls that seem to separate us dissolve. Boundless intimacy. There never was any gap. Everything is here.